Welcome to The Morning Voice. I am Ted Maxwell. I've got Matt Neely back with us this week behind the glass. Hope he had some time to get some good rest and relaxation on his week off. Although it was good to get you calling in because you came up with some brilliant music songs every once in a while. So it's good to know that even when you're on vacation, you're kind of connected with the show.
Well, Brendan had you well under control.
Oh, he did.
Week, so he had you even more on time and even more on target.
Well, yes, and I gave him a lot of challenges because I kept moving the target and I kept moving the time. So he did an outstanding job, and you've done a really nice job getting him prepared for it. And I think he's really enjoying being back there. It's a different phase.
We love having him.
And now that he's on the payroll, hopefully he's filing his taxes today and getting everything done and in. You know, the beauty of being married to an accountant.
Ah, that's right.
And Katie does not, she's on me all the time about the paperwork. And we're literally submitting stuff in February. I mean, it is done, doesn't want to play with the crowds.
Sure.
I actually could share a story when we were first dating it at one point. I think we had recognized it was going to be a lasting relationship. And I think I almost lost her when I realized, oh, man, I've got to run down to the post office. And she goes, well, are you just filing your taxes tonight? I said, I'm filing an extension.
I'm not filing my taxes. I'm filing an extension.
So I hope everybody that's filing that maybe you're getting a little money back. But remember, if you get too much money back, you've been giving the government that money for a long time. You got to figure out how to make that sum when you fill out your tax form be as close to zero as possible.
She has had a good influence on you.
Oh, in more ways than anyone could imagine. So. The engagement hour. What we're going to do for the next 2 hours is try to get people through stories and through advocacy involved and see how you can get involved. It can be in numerous different ways. I always talk about, you know, find something that you're passionate about, something you want to make a change of, and see how you can go out and do that. And today we're going to have State Representative Teresa Martinez, who represents LD 16 with us. And people, a lot of folks don't understand that LD 16 actually comes down well into Pima County, right up against I-10 over by the Tucson Mountains. And then the second hour, we will have David Godleski with the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association. And he'll talk to us about the challenge of the affordability of housing. That doesn't necessarily mean finding housing for the homeless. It doesn't necessarily mean Section 8. It really focuses a lot on the fact that we don't have a lot of housing available to our workforce. And that's something that when businesses and companies come here, they look to see, are their workers going to have access to housing? So there's a lot going on in that. But the other thing that's going to be a big day today in this region is Pima County. So they've got a Pima County board meeting this morning.
Okay.
And remember, they're down one supervisor right now.
They got to make an appointment today, correct?
So today they're going to make an appointment. There's several folks. They've all been interviewed by the League of Women Voters. Andres Cano is probably the leading candidate, former state representative. He worked in Richard Elias's office back in the day at the county, and he's currently an employee of the city of Tucson. And there had been rumors swirling for a long time about him coming back into the political spectrum, too. So I think he's probably the leading candidate. Carla Morales from PCC is involved. There's a couple folks who at the League of Women Voters got a lot of attention because they were unknowns. But they sure came up with a lot of great ideas, and a lot of people were really intrigued with what they were going to go. Unfortunately, I think they're going to learn today that the political system's the political system, and you have to work in it.
Sure.
More important, honestly, in my opinion, is they're going to have a vote on potentially who's going to be the new RTA rep. Supervisor Scott had been the RTA rep for so far the entirety of the time I've been on the RTA board, which is 4 years now. And now they had selected Supervisor Grijalva to be the RTA rep, and she was on with us for one meeting.
Wow.
So today they're going to swear in the new supervisor, and then they're going to get to making some pretty key appointments, including, I believe, to visit Tucson and some other effects. But the one I'm going to be watching is going to be that RTA, because we're getting closer and closer
to
the deadline.
Is there any thought? Is there any thought about a favorite this time around for the RTA appointment?
Well, when I look at it, I really think
there's a lot of
conversations. A lot of folks have been mentioning Rex Scott coming back and being the chair and being on the Arte because he's been working with the plan for the last 4+ years. And sometimes myself are the two that tended to could go either way on an issue, depending on what made the best sense for the community and the region at the time. But I'm also hearing Matt Hines' name also coming up too, and he's got some pretty strong opinions about the RTA. And so it'd be an interesting take. The difference between the two of them, really, from my perspective, is Rex, and I'm now talking about how they're going to view things in the region. Supervisor Scott represents LD1. Or not LD1, sorry. Got to get that right. District 1.
Sure.
And District 1 has a lot of unincorporated Pima County. It's just, I mean, it's the foothills. Okay. It's Marana, or about, it's part of Marana. It used to be a lot of Marana. Now most of that's gone off into District 3. But it comes all the way across the front of the foothills. So a lot of unincorporated Pima County. Supervisor Hines is, I believe, District 5. Mm-hmm. And that is predominantly 100% in the city of Tucson. Not 100%, but a lot of it, the majority of it. So that's just kind of a different way of looking at what the purpose and what the benefit of the RTA maybe could be. And that's, you know, we're still at the point. I'm going to give the city some credit. Their last study session, City Manager Tamir presented a lot of potential scope changes that will let a lot of these projects, you know, everybody's, I think a lot of folks are aware that there's 9 projects that aren't done yet. And a lot of them have been just arguments over the scope and what's
how many lanes
and how many lanes. Mm-hmm. And for an example, there's a Grant Road underpass from the under Union Pacific. That was a project that needs to get done. So it's going to Grant, you go under the UP, the railroads, and then under the road, and you come up on the other side again.
Sure.
There's not enough room underneath it, and Union Pacific came back and said, yeah, you can't remove those stanchions or you can't do it. So they're trying to get everything that was in the original RTA that was asked for into there, and they've come to an agreement of probably not addressing the pedestrian side of it. There is going to be some pedestrian roads, but the proposal the city had wanted to do had a large pedestrian bridge about a quarter of a mile south. It was going to be a quarter mile south, and it was going to be built up and over.
Okay.
But that's out of the corridor, and so there was a big hang-up on that one, and they've decided they're going to go forward with it. They're going to propose going forward with it without that bridge. So come back and deal with the bridge later. But they made changes to about 5 different projects, which are got small hangups now that I think gives a great opportunity to move a lot of those forward. Because the big thing we're going to want to be able to show at the end of RTA1 is, hey, the projects are getting done. Because that may be something that will lead some people to say, well, you didn't finish the first ones.
Sure.
Despite being almost $300 million short, thanks to 2008 and some other economic downturns, not to mention the cost of construction right now. There's a lot of challenges, but that will be a pretty big appointment, Matt, from my perspective. And obviously, you know, sitting on the State Transportation Board and on PAG and RTA and SALC believes RTA is one of the most important things that we've got to decide here in the coming years. Why? I mean, in the coming years, in the next year, or we lose the funding, because it's really, to me, the best example still of regionalism in this county.
Sure, that's the one you can point to.
That's the one you can point to and say, hey, that's a regional approach that works. There's some of the elected officials who are upset with where we're sitting now on it, but when you ask them bluntly, has RTA been beneficial for your city and your town? And the answer is always yes, absolutely. But like everything, sometimes, and it's not just the city of Tucson right now. Oro Valley's not on board. I think Marana's real close. Sarita's there. There's a lot of things in the plan. We're still trying to work out. But everybody thinks, well, if we don't do this, then we can just implement our own half-cent sales tax. But everybody forgets 36% of the people in this community live in unincorporated Pima County.
Yep.
And Pima County doesn't have that option. I mean, they could, but then that's going to be added to
every
unanimous municipality. Yeah, and it has to be unanimous.
It has to be unanimous.
So it's going to be an interesting thing. It's going to be an interesting day. I understand Supervisor Christie will not be there today. So that means when they do the first election of the new member, they'll be down to 3 members. I think he may be missing the first meeting he's missed in 9 years.
No kidding.
Yeah. I spoke with him yesterday, and him and his family is going to take some well-deserved time, and they're taking a big family trip. And so I hope he has a good time on that trip. You know, there's nobody that loves being your supervisor more than Supervisor Christie.
He'll tell you. So he says.
So he says. But it's gonna make for an interesting thing to watch. So I'll be watching that after this today. So for all those that don't get quite into that kind of political weeds, good morning and welcome to Tax Day. So we're gonna cut to a break now. We hoped we'll have Representative Teresa Martinez on the line with us when we get back. And it looks like she just joined. So you're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. That's Matt Neely. And that's we had a little talk about that song before we came on there. It's truly an amazing song that takes me back to kind of the response of the country after 9/11. They played the Super Bowl right after that. And that's one, it always brings a smile back to my face and thinks about how it's great when the country comes together. Speaking of coming together, we've got with us today the Representative Teresa Martinez, representing the 16th District. Representative Martinez, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Ted. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. It's great to have you on. There's so much to talk about that's going on in the state legislature. You've been in the press a little bit lately. I want to say up front that Representative Martinez is not one to sit back and wait for things to happen. We'll get into it a little later, but she's had me out on SR 347 at 6 o'clock in the morning, watching the traffic up there. And so there's a lot going on, and I appreciate how involved and how vocal you are in the state legislature. But before we go there, the point of this show is to kind of highlight how folks come to the decision to get involved and get engaged. So I'd love for you to tell a little bit of the background, and I think it's important for the folks down here in Pima County to understand you represent LD 16, which now comes down a lot into Pima County. You almost hit I-10 down there by the Tucson Mountains. So how did you get started? You grew up in Casa Grande. Your dad was a miner. You were a teacher for a long time. What finally made you to step into that decision to step into the political world?
Well, the first step was I was working at a gym during the summer because high school substitute teachers don't have a job in the summer. And so I needed a job. I was working at a gym, and this guy came in and he said, you should help volunteer because I think you're a Republican. So I volunteered a little bit for Congressman J.D. Hayworth. And then I met Congressman Rick Renzi, and I volunteered for him. And he says, you know, I'm just going to hire you. And literally, I don't know, a few months later, I was in D.C. and I was working for a United States congressman. And so that kind of started me in the back way to politics, working for a congressman, because not only do you have to govern, but you also have to campaign. And that's really what started. It was just dumb luck. And then the way I got into actual elected office was my representative, Brett Roberts, had moved, and they were going to appoint. And I thought, you know, I could do that for 2 years, you know, make a little bit of a difference and then, you know, step out. And they said, well, if we select you, will you run? And I said, oh, sure. You know, thinking that I wasn't going to be selected. And they selected me and I was appointed. So again, kind of the back way in. And I served, and I thought, gosh, do I really want to do this? And I was driving up the I-10 between Casa Grande and Phoenix. And it's a 2-lane highway, as you well know. And I was stuck. And I sent a total of 3 videos to Governor Ducey's office. Governor Ducey never responded. He did get them because he did tell me earlier, yeah, I got them. And they said, after the 3rd video, would you like to talk to ADOT about the widening of the I-10. And I said, yes, I would. Probably about 60 days later, or a month, 2 months later, they had these big signs that said commercial traffic over to the right. And I thought, I did that. And I, at that point, I was like, you know what? Let's do this and let's really make some good stuff happen. And so that's kind of, I just found myself getting in the way, an unusual way, on both the government and the politics.
Well, there's no doubt that since you've been involved, you've gotten engaged, and you actually rose pretty quick on some of the leadership, and some of that's, I think, the way you like to engage. You aren't afraid to say what you're going to say, and the fact of the matter is, while, yes, you're a very conservative Republican member, you're not afraid to vote on the other side of the aisle if it's somebody that's cooperated or worked with you before, and it's a bill that you think makes sense. So you've kind of got this niche now up at the legislature. How would you say that's been working to either your advantage or your disadvantage inside the party politics?
I'm sorry, Chad. What did you say?
I was asking you how you thought you're the
Chad,
way that...
Are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Hello?
Hold on.
Chad?
Hold on.
Chad. Oh, gosh. Are you there?
I've got you.
So she's going to call back and...
All right. Well, I'll tell you the.
Yeah, it's funny.
The
engagement. Hey there, Teresa. We could hear you. You couldn't hear us. Hang on a second, okay? Hello.
It must be tax day or something. Strange things are going on. It's really interesting on what individual legislators can get done when it comes to things like I-11. A lot of people don't realize how much money every year the legislature will put into funds specifically for projects. Now, I-10, but I-10 is being funded with funding from the expansion, and it has begun, and the next phase is going to be starting soon. Is she back on? All right.
Yep, I'm here.
All right. We've got you back. Good. I was starting to go down a Interstate 10 ramble. And by the way, I appreciated you getting those signs in place. I wish they just put them up more often, because for those of us who drive up that road every day. So you led into that. And Teresa, I was going to go another direction, but I'd rather just let's stay on the infrastructure, because it was 347 that got you engaged, decided to run again, and you saw that you can make a difference. Can you talk a little bit about some of the role you've played in getting money for the widening of I-10 and how the state legislature can actually make those kind of put those bills forward that give the funding to do projects throughout the state for infrastructure?
Well, basically, I nagged them. I nagged them until they couldn't take it no more. That's it in a nutshell. You know, at the legislature, you have to fight for what you want, and you have to be relentless about it. It is definitely one of those things where the squeaky wheel gets the oil. Moving to the side, and kind of going back and forth with what your previous question was working with the other side of the aisle. When you work with 60 members, 90 members, and if you include the Senate, you have a lot of people with a lot of different ideas. You talked about more signs. I agree with you. I think we have to have more signs up that I-10 and the 347. But, you know, ADOT thinks that people will hit them. And I'm like, I don't think that's the case. And so some of the infrastructure is really about coming to a consensus of what everybody thinks is the right thing, which is why I think government moves so slow, you know, for some people. And with regards to the infrastructure, you know, we collect revenue, you know, from income tax, from sales tax. And when we collect those monies, we're able to use them for whatever it is we want, infrastructure being probably the main thing. And we are able to utilize grants. And so that's one of the things, like federal grants. And those federal grants are key. And when it comes down to the I-10 widening, a proponent who doesn't get a lot of accolades but did really the yeoman's work was Governor Stephen Lewis of the Gila River Indian Community. He went to D.C. a number of times and really went over to shake some of that money loose. And so hats off to him. But it's a big undertaking, as you know, because roads are super expensive.
Well, there's no doubt that they don't come cheap, and it is it's always a competition. And I think you've been watching the competition for SR 347. The town of Maricopa is part of MAG, but the interesting thing is they don't benefit from the regional funding, or MAGS, what we'll call MAGS RTA, even though it's not an RTA, but since the listeners down here understand what the RTA is, they don't really benefit from that. So they've really been having to get people like yourself to advocate and bring people, members of the State Transportation Board there, to try to move 347 forward. And it looks like we're finally making some progress.
Oh, absolutely. And so, again, we go to the squeaky wheel, and how bad do you want it? The 347, they formed a little group, and it's, I don't know, maybe five or seven people in this group, not counting me. So that's not counting me or TJ, Senator Shoup, or Representative Chris Lopez. That's not counting us. And this little group got together. They put together a website and an email blast, and they literally have maybe about 800 to 900 people that subscribe to their thing. Where you think, oh, that's 800 to 900 people in a town of 70,000. That doesn't seem a lot. But I'm going to tell you what, they literally email the legislature, I don't know, three times a month. And we're talking 100, 200, 300 people, where the other legislators were like, where is 347?
And Teresa, we've got to jump to a break, but I get at least a dozen emails from SR 347 FACS. So stay with us, please. We're going to talk with Representative Teresa Martinez, and we'll be right back after the bottom of the hour break.
Robert Cray singing those 1040 blues.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. That's Matt Neely doing a nice blend of U2 versus 1040 Texas Blues. So thanks for bringing that on. Representative Martinez, glad to have you with us, and I appreciate all you're doing up at the state legislature.
Well, thank you.
So one of the things we talked about when I met with you earlier this year, you've risen pretty fast. You were the majority whip last year, something you're very good at because you go out and you can stir folks up and get them engaged. But you're also, as you mentioned, you'll work with all 60. This year, it's kind of a different session for you. And how would you describe your view in this session?
You know, every year is different, even if the representatives are the same, which is really a unique thing that I was sort of surprised about. It has been an interesting one. We've had a presidential election. We had, a population, a mandate say that this immigration issue is a big, big deal. And there are some things that, caught me off guard in a good way and then caught me off guard in a bad way. And I'm a person who wants clarity. You know, if you're yes with me, great. If you're no with me, then that's fine too. Just be upfront and be honest with who you are, what it is you want, and just be straightforward. And I definitely operate in that realm. I am definitely straightforward. Governor Hobbs did a speech, opening day ceremony, and she talked about working with the Trump administration with regards to securing the border. And I thought, okay, that's fantastic. Then, 2 weeks later, she's talking about not working with the Trump administration on immigration. And so which is it? And so I put a bill together. That's the immigration bill you were talking about, right? That's 2099?
Yes, HB 2099, and it's been in the press a little bit, which means you've been in the press a little bit.
I have been. I've actually been in the press more on a different bill, but that particular bill is just very, very clear. It says that we are going to cooperate with the administration to get this under control. It does have a sunset date because I do believe in states' rights. But at this point, what I don't like to see happening is I don't like to see us commit lawfare with the administration. It is against the law to be in this country illegally. It doesn't matter. It's black or it's white. If you're in this country illegally, you have committed a crime. Now, some will argue, well, it's not a serious crime, like shoplifting. Shoplifting's not a serious crime, but it's a crime. And it can be detrimental, to the community if enough people do it. And so that's why I put the bill together. The Democrats were not thrilled with it. I don't know if Katie Hobbs will sign it, but we will see.
And can you describe a little bit about what it does and maybe more importantly, too, what it doesn't do? Because a lot of people are making comparisons to some things that I don't think exist in the bill. But can you kind of talk about what 2099 will basically...
It says that the governor, the AG, the city and the municipalities and the counties will cooperate with federal immigration law. And what that means is... we'll go ahead and take cities, for example. This would prohibit a city from becoming a sanctuary city. This would a county. So, you know, ICE comes up and they've detained the county police, sheriffs have detained a person. They're holding them. They're illegal. They would be they would have to cooperate with ICE officials and be able to come and pick up those folks from a jail, which I think is better than going to their house in a random neighborhood and, you know, having the SWAT team come out and pull out some guy out of his house. I think picking him up at a detention facility at the jail is a better way, a safer way for all parties to go out. So that's what it does. It commits the governor and the AG to cooperate with the Trump administration with regards to the federal laws. That's what it does.
Absolutely. And I think you mentioned it there. You referenced the jails when they're already in control. It's not mandating, as I understand it, that the local police force, or the local sheriffs need to go out and search and try to find these folks. But once they've come in contact with them, then
Correct. They
need to cooperate with the federal law.
Yes. So, and that is 100% correct. This is not some sort of mandate to go, you know, door to door to search for every illegal immigrant that is in here. That's not what that bill does. What this bill does is it works with the municipalities. It works with the county officials. It works with, you know, with government to work within the frames of government to cooperate. It chaps my hide that, you know, we have people who want to prevent the government from doing the job that they're supposed to do, which is protect our borders, which is to create a safe environment. You know, I think it's ridiculous for the Supreme Court, for the United States Supreme Court, to be wanting to bring back a guy who is illegally in the country, or was illegally in the country, who is suspected on the being a gang member, MS-13. And how people are fighting to bring him back. It's almost as though we've deported a United States citizen. That is not the case. He was here illegally. He was already in removal proceedings. He had already seen an immigration judge, and the immigration judge had said, no, you got to be deported. And then he wants to go through appeal. And I understand that there is an appeal process, but once an immigration judge says, you must be deported. I don't understand why people are still fighting to keep this guy here. And then they say, well, due process. He's entitled. No, he's not entitled. He's not entitled because he's here in the country illegally. And so when it comes to the governor kind of looping its way back to the bill, you know, Governor Hobbs, if you're going to work with the Trump administration, thank you. Kudos. Thank you for putting the United States, the Arizona citizens, in your main concern. Thank you for doing that. But if you're not going to do it, then that's also, you know, then let us know so that we can do it for you. And this is really going to show her colors to see if she indeed supports immigration like she says she is and border security or if she doesn't.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion on the due process and a lot of these issues now. But what I definitely want to go back to is that last statement you made, because that's what's been the criticism in here is people. Yeah, and you've been blunt about it. You've been honest. You said, yes, there's a little politics in this bill. This is a bill. I'm giving the governor an opportunity to say, you said this. Now here's your chance to do it. And as you mentioned, next year, when the elections come down, there will be a lot of discussion on what you say and what you do, because we hear that a lot from politicians is there's criticism from the communities on what you say and what you do. So you've made it clear that part of this bill is to put the governor on record for the run next year.
Absolutely, because it just, you know, a
a lot of people get those mailers and they see those commercials, and those commercials will be like, you know, she's working with President Trump, you know, to secure this border. She's independent like Arizona and all this and that, with when in the background, she's actually doing everything but that. She's doing everything but working with the Trump administration. I'll be honest with you. From what I've seen of Governor Hobbs, she has not been the thorn in President Trump's side compared to the AG. The Attorney General, Chris Mays, has taken every opportunity that she can to sue the Trump administration. And, you know, my thought is you are spending your time and your resources suing the Trump administration for gangbangers, rapists, murderers who are in this country illegally. And yet, what other crimes are you letting go? You know, she's got a consumer fraud division. You know, I don't know if she's doing, how many consumer fraud issues she's working. I do know that the Attorney General's office with regards to how many lawyers they have is limited. So, you know, she does have a finite set of resources that she can use. And she is really aiming both barrels at President Trump. And so the last thing I want to see is President Trump's approval ratings, because he got eggs down back to $1, gas back under $3, you know, $2.50, dare to dream. And now she's going to proclaim, oh, you know, we're working with the Trump administration. And I hate those kinds of lies. And a lot of the folks out there who get these mailers, who see these commercials are going to go, oh, wow, look at her. She's really working with the Trump. Good for her. And I just, it chaps my hide, Ted, is what it does. And I just, you know, I want to put them on record. I'm on record.
Well, you know, this is Matt, Representative Martinez, and I tell you what, every time I see, there's been at least 10, maybe 11 of these lawsuits that the Attorney General has brought against the Trump administration, and every time I see another one come up in the news feed, I'm like, wow, so we don't have any crime to fight in Arizona? Is that what we're dealing with? Is that what we're at here?
Well, it sure seems like it, because I can tell you that, you know, she has joined every kind of lawsuit, and she's an aggressive woman. She is not somebody who you know, sits in the corner and just waits to be called on. No, she's very aggressive. And when she signs on, she's literally doing the work. And so, you know, she's got a consumer fraud that she's not checked into. You know, there's an election law. That little girl, Emily Pike, they're investigating that as well. They're investigating the group homes. You don't ever hear any of that on the group homes. And that's a big story up in the Valley.
Well, sure. The governor got huge rate increases for somebody who was a donor to her campaign. And nobody else got rate increases.
And now they're going to be bankrupt. And now they're going bankrupt. And so you look at these group homes. Who's investigating that, Chris Mays? And so she says she is. She sent me a letter that she was. And, you know, as a legislator, all I can do is like, okay, I see what you've done there. I've seen your move. Great. So now next session, I'm going to have to create a law that reports, you know, some sort of quarterly report on, you know, performance on a website that we can monitor. Because, and I think that's really the friction of the legislature with the AG and the governor. You know, we're going to have to start to work in a way where, you know, the separation of government is really going to play out.
Well, there's no doubt. I don't think any of us like seeing everything get bogged down in the courts. Especially when there appears to be political ramifications behind it. And I think sometimes that cuts both ways. We drag a lot of things into court that have no business in court. You know, we elected officials are elected to make the decisions, to be the decision makers. I'm all for going to the voters when you need to, but not for everything. Once you're elected, you got to make the decisions. That's one of the things I do appreciate about you, Representative Martinez, is you're vocal, you're involved, and you're engaged. There's no doubt about it, and you're going to call it like you see it, and you're going to go forward. So one of our early times we met was when you showed up at the ADOT board meetings and testified on behalf of 347, so I want to give you some credit for getting that whole group started. And I do believe you're going to make it into the five-year plan. We had a study session just last week on 347. And once again, Mayor Smith and the several members of that group showed up. So I want to give you some congratulations. Even though you don't live in Maricopa, you represent it, and you're doing a good job of trying to bring that through. So any last thoughts you have before I let you get back to the business of making laws?
Well, thank you. Thank you so very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure. I'm glad that you did. I'm thrilled about the 347 and making it in the 5-year plan. I'd be remiss to just take the credit for that. That is really the community, James Singleton and Bill Robertson and some, you know, really great folks along with Mayor Nancy Smith down there have really done a lot of the legwork, and I greatly appreciate them. I'm just helping push the cart up the road. No pun intended. So, but thank you. I think one of the things I'd love for all your listeners to know is that we, the representatives, represent you, and it's important that you, as a constituent, you as a community member, reach out to your representatives and make your voice be heard. And if we're doing something boneheaded, please call us out on it. If we're doing something you like, please let us know. And a lot of us are not mind readers. So really, we enjoy the contact from constituents. So please continue to do that.
That's a great way to finish it, Representative Martinez. Teresa, I really appreciate you being on the show today. And I appreciate all you're doing for the state of Arizona. So we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Ted. And bye, Matt. Nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
All right.
Bye.
You've been listening to State Representative of LD, representing LD 16, Teresa Martinez, on 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Appreciate Representative Martinez coming on. It kind of set the table saying you're going to hear from her what she's thinking. And she's that way. When we were out there at 6 o'clock in the morning on SR 347, she was making sure that I recognized all the cars, the amount of trucks. And I think that was something we obviously wanted to get and cover her 2099 bill. Because she's been pretty vocal about why she's doing it. And I wanted to also make sure that everybody at least was aware that this is, you know, some people take it back to 1070 and say it's like that, but it's not, it does not require or even have any language in it saying that the local police force should go up and help. It's just, they need to cooperate when it's time. So it's going to get political attention going forward. It's going to be a big issue on next year's, election for sure when it comes to the ballot, and it's going to be an interesting campaign year next year. If we thought that the politics have already led into this year's both federal and state legislators, get ready for next year, people. It'll be time to hold on. That's going to be a big election in the fall of 2026. So quick turn. When we have a guest on that we go along with, we've got to make it back, and we will be going to the top of the hour break now. And when you get back, I hope I will see David Godlewski with the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association in the waiting room. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back.
The Morning Voice will be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, keeping us on time and target.
I don't think I kept us on target 10 minutes ago, but we're working on
Got it. It's been rolling, you know. There was a great conversation with the Representative Martinez. As I had mentioned, she used to be the majority whip. She's no longer that. But she's still very vocal. She's very vocal in the legislature, and she definitely shows up.
A real quick story. My friend Frank Antonori was the majority whip when he was in the Senate, I think, on the Senate side. And so some journalist here wrote about, well, he's so very partisan. I'm like, well, that's literally his job, is to whip votes for the caucus that he represents. Anyway, so
and that's what it is. People go, well, why do they call it the whip? Well, you know, it's always you get out the whip and you get everybody in line. That's what they're trying to do. Maybe a little carryover from earlier times in our country that's not necessarily appropriate, but they still use it. They use it in Congress. They use that. But the intent is that's what they're supposed to do, and they get very partisan. I think that's where she, I won't say got herself in trouble last year, because she made it very clear that she will vote with people from both sides, especially if they've supported past bills that she's put forward. So, but you can tell she's definitely engaged. She's definitely got her thoughts and ideas and where she's going to take the path. Now we've got with another person who's incredibly engaged. We'll see if he's as vocal and with thoughts and ideas, but we're joined by David Godleski with the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association this morning, and a very active participant in our community. Morning, David. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Ted. Happy to be here.
Well, the engagement hour, one of the things we focus on is literally trying to get people involved. And we do that through your stories and the stories and the advocacy and what you're doing to try to get maybe some of the listeners that go, you know what, I'd really could get involved in that, or I could do this. So always have to start with the first thing when it's first time on the show is, how did you come to Tucson, and then how did you get involved in the role you're at? Because you're very prominent, one of the seven members of the Tucson Business Alliance, and a guest quite often on the radio with other shows as well, not just this one.
Well,
so.
I appreciate, prominent may be a subjective term, but I appreciate
it. It may not be one you want, right, but you do get cited quite a bit.
Yeah,
you can't
absolutely
help that.
So I've been in Tucson since summer of 2008, and it's when you're looking back, you see how time flies. And I'm a Midwest transplant. Grew up, born and raised in suburbs of Detroit, Michigan, and spent a lot of time working in political campaigns and government affairs at the state capitol in Michigan in Lansing. Family actually is what brought us out to Tucson in 2008. And at that time, I was really just looking for an organization that I could establish roots with, see myself there for a long period of time, still be involved in that government affairs, public relations, community building type of a position. And really it was kind of just an one-off occurrence where I had heard about a government affairs job open at the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association. My wife already had a job lined up out here. And so at that time, the housing market, particularly in Michigan, was just an absolute disaster. And so it was, I either needed to find a job or we needed to sell the house before I could come out to Tucson. And so when I heard about the opening at Saba, I called and I begged and I pleaded and I said, I'll get on the plane tomorrow if you just give me an interview. And they took me up on it. And so I got hired in, like I said, the summer of 2008 to be involved in leading the association's government affairs efforts.
2008, not exactly the perfect time to take a new job in the home building world. What was your initial impression when you came to Tucson? You obviously had family, mm-hmm. and so you knew a little bit about it. And then what was your impression when you came in and saw the situation with the home builders?
Well, one of the things that attracted to us and made it a little easier to make the transition, I was talking to folks and they were saying, look, Tucson is one of the fastest growing communities in the country. And so that was really appealing to me, the amount of home building activity and economic development activity at that particular time. So it was like, hey, let's relocate, improved weather, let's kind of get in on the ground floor and see where this thing goes. But there was the dynamic of what was happening in the housing market in the time. And I remember talking to one of my predecessors, the gentleman who hired me, and I said, hey, look, things in Michigan are not going good, right? It was we were already starting to see the signs of the foreclosure issues and just the housing downfall that was part of that Great Recession, and said, why do I want to come to Tucson and be involved in home building? And at that time, nobody really knew how long or how deep the recession was going to be. And it was like, oh, it's going to be, 6 months and things are going to pick back up. And Tucson's a great place. We've got the weather. We'll have, retirees are always want to come here, it's going to be great. And I'll tell you what, those first couple of years were pretty rough on the economy and in the community and local government revenue and home builders. And to put a little perspective on it, so in 2008, when I started, we had a membership of over 750 members. And then when I took over in my current role in 2011, we were down to about 265 or so. I think when I was hired, we had 16 full-time employees. And then that year in 2011, I think it got down to like three of us or something like that. So it was pretty startling.
That's actually an amazing stat that you don't hear people talk about. It tells you how bad that 2008 recession and the activity in the housing market really made an impact. So what was your plan when you took over? I mean, you know, it's kind of like, thanks, boss. I appreciate you hiring me. And really, this is what you're leaving me with. What was your plan at that point to turn things around?
You know, I think it was, you know, the big thing for me when I, you know, even was first hired in that government affairs role was, you know, it was far enough removed, but still it was fairly fresh. The dynamics related to home building and land development and the environmental issues, whether it was the Coalition for Sonoran Desert Protection and trying to get the conservation plan and CLS passed and pygmy owl issues. There was a lot of tension that I think had built up and the home builders and land development interests were a bit of a flashpoint and not very highly regarded in the community. And so one of the things that I really tried to do was make sure that we were engaging in a very you know, practical way that was considerate of everybody's interests, that we couldn't, steamroll anybody and needed to be sensitive of what our community ethics and priorities were and really try and take an approach of how can we achieve sound public policy that helps us achieve the housing needs of a growing community and withstand market fluctuations. And so it was really important to me to set that tone first, to make sure that we were living up to our tagline as the community builder and supporting workforce development initiatives and other kinds of community efforts to support and get people housed and sheltered. And I think we were able to do that. And then just slowly building back the membership and obviously, really coming out of that recession, things started to pick back up. It was much longer than we anticipated, but we were able to grow substantially. So
one of the areas that I first met you when I came onto Southern Arizona Leadership Council and was working in was water. You were incredibly involved in water at the time. You were the one of the two co-chairs of the Tucson Regional Water Coalition, which was predominantly made of business members, but also a lot of engagement with the electeds, the people that were working in water. Can you kind of talk about that philosophy of being a community builder and why it was important for Saba and the home builders to be engaged in the water discussion?
Well, and coming from a place like Michigan where you are literally surrounded by lakes, right? You probably do take water for granted. And it was apparent to me, I mean, really right away when I got to Tucson, that water was a very precious resource. And it was something that we had to be incredibly mindful of, or we weren't going to be able to grow in the way that we're prepared to do. And so you had to, you have to be cognizant about household water consumption. We have to be cognizant about how, as a region, we kind of master plan all of our water use and our water resources. And so given the link between housing and water, it was important for Saba to be kind of front and center in those conversations, especially in the organizations that were representing business interests. And kind of when I first got involved in that, 2009, 10 time period, there was a lot of discussion. It was the city and the county were doing their water, wastewater studies, and there were gray water ordinances and commercial rainwater harvesting ordinances that were really progressive in what they were trying to do. And so we wanted to engage and make sure that that there were cost benefit analysis done, and that there were things to make sure that we weren't doing anything that was going to jeopardize economic development in housing. And so it's water is an incredibly complicated topic. It's, there's a local component, a state component, a federal component. We're reliant on the Colorado River and the CAP here in Tucson. And so there's just so many different layers, and you really, it's very hard to get your arms around it. But the bottom line is just trying to make sure, again, that we're approaching it from a sound public policy standpoint, and not picking winners and losers or prioritizing one interest over another.
Well, I really appreciate the work you've done in the water space. I've learned a lot from you and with you, and it's kind of like you said, you got involved because the impact of the housing, probably never thought you'd be working on the drought contingency plan before it was over, for the Colorado River Compact. It's kind of an amazing thing. I think you've set us up in a really good position. We're going to go to break real quick, David, but when we come back, we're going to talk about how all that's impacted the housing market and get your sense of where we are now versus where we were coming out of that recession in 2011.
Sounds great.
All right. You're listening to the voice of David Godlesky, the president CEO of the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association. And you're on 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. And we'll be right back after the break. Welcome back. You are listening to The Morning Voice. Matt, appreciate the selections you're doing when you're spreading between the tax situation and the U2. And I always actually forget how much I enjoy U2. It's just one of those bands that there's so many songs out there that are just, just all on top.
Seen
of
them
it.
Once. It's Sun Devil Stadium, actually.
When?
I don't know what it was called at the time.
When?
97, 8.
Okay. I saw him at Sun Devil Stadium in 90, right about the turn.
Oh, wow.
Right,
okay.
And it was Sun Devil Stadium back then when I saw them there too. So that's the only U2 appearance on the concert spectrum. But yeah, it was a great concert. They quite often pull people back up. They pulled some teenager up who played the guitar with them and off, out of the crowd. And they do that a lot at their concerts, but they've got a long history. There's a reason they're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so great job on some of those selections. So you are listening to The Morning Voice 5 days a week, 7 to 9 in the morning on the Bustos Media Station, 1030 The Voice. Five different hosts, five different opinions, and five different shows, but they're all worth listening into, and you're going to catch a ton of different targets. And tomorrow Grant Krueger will be on, and he mixes food and politics, and he's really going to mix it tomorrow, as he's got Ward 6 candidate Jay Tolkoff coming on the radio with him, a former restaurant owner. So it's going to be an interesting day to tune in and listen to Grant and his show. So with me today is David Godlesky on the Engagement Hour, the president and CEO of Saba. We've talked about a lot of your experiences coming in, moving into Tucson, why you came here, why you got engaged, and why you got involved, and some of the challenges that the home builders faced right after the recession. That's right about the time, we could blame it on you. I guess you got hired in 2008.
Right,
but eventually in 2011, your boss said, okay, I'm moving on, and you said, okay, I'll step in. How's the housing market looking today? What kind of was the progression of the things that maybe you did, or how the market recovered from 11 to today?
Sure. Well, Ted, I think that's a great setup in looking at where we were at that time in the early 2000s, that 2000, 4, 5, and 6 time period. As a region, Southern Arizona was doing about 10,000 single family permits on average. And that's how we really look at the health of the market, is how many permits are being pulled. A permit essentially has to be issued before construction on a home can begin. And in, I think it was 2011, it was at the bottom, and we were around 1,500 single family permits that year. I like to say that if you look at maybe a 20 or 30 year average, take out the highs, take out the lows, we should be somewhere in the range of 5,000 single family permits per year to keep up with demand and provide the housing that we need as a community. And we were steadily moving towards that number in the 20 teens. And then really in 2020, this time 5 years ago, with the onset of the the pandemic, and we were in a period of time where I think everybody was at the onset was expecting that we were going to see another housing recession. It was certainly something that I was fearful of, is that that was just going to, really bring things to a halt. We actually saw the opposite happen. There was just such a tremendous demand at that time for housing, for remodeling of homes, and with all of the related supply chain issues and other challenges that were COVID related, we were just not able to keep up in a timely way. But somehow we saw a huge increase in permitting activity in 2020, 21, in the start of 2022, and then in that summer of 2022, we saw the interest rates skyrocket. And so it's been a rocky road the past few years. I mean, there have been a lot of challenges that the builders have had to navigate. They've had to get incredibly creative. And so the past, we were kind of moving through that interest rate time period. Last year, we finished with around like 4,300 single family permits. Right now, though, we're off. We are definitely behind where we were at this point last year. I think people are relatively optimistic about being able to gain ground the remainder of the year, but there, no doubt, there's some challenges on the horizon.
Well, some people probably hear the number 5,000 and they think, wow, that's a lot of new homes. But you talked about when you got here, this region was booming, people were moving here, kind of slowed down, kind of went away. After 2020, I think you saw an influx of folks moving predominantly from California, coming here, not wanting to relocate to the Valley. It was a little bit more LA-esque because it's getting so large. So they started looking here again. I think you've seen that. What's driving the market now? What's driving the demand?
I think the big thing we have this dynamic where the resale housing sector is certainly, I think, constrained by inventory. And so what you have is this dynamic where if you are someone who's you're locked into your 30-year fixed mortgage and you're at a 3% mortgage interest rate, what's the incentive for you to leave that house and pay almost 7% interest? And so you've really seen things on the resale side that has caused people to sit on the sidelines, and that in many ways has helped on the new home construction side, where people see that their dollars can go further than they did before. The builders have gotten creative in terms of buying down the interest rate, at least for the first couple of years, so that they can pay something that's less than what they might in a resale situation. So that's been helpful. And there's just there is a certain amount of churn in the market where people are looking, and Tucson is a desirable place. I mean, we are, from an affordability standpoint, I think if you look at indicators like the MAP dashboard, we're still a community that has affordable housing compared to some of the other hotter markets that you mentioned out of state or in the Phoenix area.
What parts of the region do you see that growth going on? Because we talk about, when we say Tucson, we mean the community. I mean, I've always said nobody goes around saying, hey, you're back east, you don't tell people, I live in Oro Valley. You tell them, I live in Tucson. So when you say the Tucson market, we're talking Oro Valley, Vail, Marana, the whole county, effectively. It's categorized as Tucson. Where do you see the growth?
I like to say you can't move the land, right? And so if you need to build 4,000, 5,000 homes a year, you have to be able to bite off big chunks and go to where the land is. And so we've seen the most growth and currently the most activity is in that northwest side, that Marana North. The southwest is another area that's going to be see a lot of growth, and then certainly the southeast, the Vail area. I expect that over the next, 5, potentially 10 years to do maybe even 30% of all of the home building activity. So you do have those pockets where you're going to see much more growth in home building activity.
That's interesting, because Marana, obviously, we know Marana is a booming town. It's growing. There's opportunities for businesses, manufacturing firms, they're building, they're doing things. But then the other two segments you talk about growth are both effectively unincorporated Pima County.
That's correct, yes.
So that's going to change a lot of the dynamics I think we've got in this region. How is it on the affordability side?
Well, that's really, I think, those communities are where you're going to be able to produce housing that is more affordable. That's where you're going to see the homes that are available to those first time home buyers, and that's because you're able to your land costs are lower. You're able to get economies of scale. If you're building a much larger subdivision, you don't necessarily have the issues or challenges if you're building an infill project from opposition. Right now, the median home price is about $407,000. I think that's a big number. And so we've got some issues on affordability.
Well, David, great tease. I hope everybody will stay with us. We've got one more segment with David Godleski, the president and CEO of the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association, and we'll talk about the affordability issues we face in this community. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be back after the bottom of the hour break. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, keeping us on time and target as always. And David Godleski is with us talking about the housing situation in this region. We have seen a slowdown in growth, but that to me doesn't mean that there's not potential. I think one of the challenges is what you mentioned right before we went to the break. The average median home now is $405,000. On the market.
New home.
Well, and when you throw the used homes, does it significantly drop?
No, not much. And that's one of the things I was touching on right now, that difference between the new home price and the resale home price isn't that great right now.
And that drives you to the new home market because,
correct,
like you pointed out, the new home builders can offer some benefits that you're not going to get on buying a second home from a private party.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you get the customization, you get the energy efficiency. Everybody likes things that are new, so it definitely has its advantages right now.
Well, you talked about you have to build where the land is. Mm-hmm. What are the big issues that are putting us in this position where 405,000 is the median new home, and that's not within a range of the normal average, residential income?
Well, I would say, we have to make sure that as we're addressing the issue of housing and particularly affordability, there is that economic development component. And we need to be doing whatever we can as a region to attract the quality jobs, the investors, to grow the businesses that are here, to raise that area median income. And I think that's a critical component that doesn't get talked about enough. When it comes to the kind of the cost inputs and the issues that affect housing costs and affordability, we talk about the five L's. So you've got land, labor, lumber, legislation, and lending. And so those are kind of the big five components that really affect home pricing. In the land, we've really seen a significant increase in land costs over the past few years, and that's because those land owners have seen the level of demand for housing, and so they know that they have a valuable commodity, and they want to optimize that. There just aren't enough finished lots out there available, so those finished lots are at a premium for the home builders. Obviously, something that is everybody knows about is just the increase in material prices that have happened over the past few years. And certainly what we've heard about tariffs is something that we're keeping our eye on and could have an effect. We just haven't had enough labor, not enough people interested in getting involved in the construction trade, something that we're working on. I touched on the interest rates. And then legislation's a big one. That's certainly something that I talk about, that, of those five things, what's within our control as a region, and definitely the public policy and the regulatory aspect is something that is we can focus on and try and work on. We're part of the National Association of Home Builders, and they do a neat study. It's called the Priced Out Index, and they can tell you how many households get priced out of a home based on your region's median home price. And so at that $407,000 median home price, for every $1,000 of increased costs, about 450 households get priced out or can't afford that house anymore. And so that's when we're dealing with these policy and regulatory issues. Every $1,000 matters. It makes a big difference.
And a lot of people like to take this housing affordability and they immediately think we're talking, you know, the housing the unhoused, how the homeless, how can we get them in it? But the fact of the matter is it's got to be a full spectrum solution. You can't just focus on building low-income housing or tiny homes. Or it's, if we don't have the folks working already having the ability to afford a house and start their path towards wealth, because that's where you get the best equities in your home ownership. That's been proven year after year after year. Then you don't open up some of the other housing options to people. So
no question. I think that, you know, we talk about the housing continuum, and that is from those, from the unsheltered, and that is a priority for this region, especially that we've got to come up with solutions in that area, but that's all the way up to the, you know, to the family that's moving into that dream custom home. And so we've got to make sure all the segments along the way are identified. We have clear metrics and goals for what we want to accomplish in those segments, and then coming up with a broader strategy and approach to try and make sure the entire market is hitting on all cylinders. And there is that, definitely there's a delineation. It's typically considered where there's housing that is that government taxpayer subsidized housing that isn't, you know, it's an important component as a society for people who are making 80% or lower of area median income. And then that market rate housing of, you know, usually we kind of talk about 120% of AMI and higher. And then you've got that sweet spot in the middle that's going to be kind of a combination of both. But it's, there isn't just one silver bullet solution to this housing affordability issue.
So does Saba work with the multi-housing organizations that build multi-housing units and stuff? Are you predominantly single family homes?
We are predominantly single family for sale housing. We've seen an increase in single family for rent, and do have some members who do that and do that very well. We have members who do multifamily as well, but that's not our primary focus. We do have, I think, a good partnership with Arizona Multi-Housing Association for sure on some legislative issues in particular.
So you broke down your five L's. Mm-hmm. Which one is the one you think we can have the biggest impact on?
Personally, I think it's legislation. I do think that we need to have a, you know, every time that we're looking at trying to adopt or implement or change or update any type of regulatory document, whether it's design guidelines or floodplain management plans or building codes or land use code amendments, we've got to consider the impact to the cost of housing. And, you know, oftentimes I hear, well, you know, we need to protect the environment. We need to, you know, mitigate climate change. Well, we need to, fill in the blank. Well, I think we also need to make sure that we're keeping housing affordable. And I don't see these as mutually exclusive. I think there are ways to do it together, but it is certainly within our purview to influence the cost of construction. And the other one I would say kind of 1A, 1B would be infrastructure. We absolutely have to make sure that we're investing in infrastructure and roads and drainage and all kinds of infrastructure to open up the land, to bring it to market for those first-time home buyers at a more affordable price point.
And I think that's a great point. The infrastructure is not there. The land doesn't become available. It's not usable.
Correct.
And then it all goes on the builders to put it in, and then the price of the house goes up. So when you say legislation, what's more important, local and regional or statewide?
Local.
Okay.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think that's where, you know, we have that true opportunity to come up with those solutions and try and encourage and incentivize and really prioritize what our legislative or policy focus is going to be.
Well, David, I appreciate all you do for the community, because it's not just the home builders that you're engaged.
Thank you.
You are engaged across all the different ones. You've I won't say you've stepped back from water, but I want you to step back in hard. I know you're still doing it on behalf of the
putting
home builders.
Putting me on the spot on the air, right?
But yeah, absolutely. Any chance I get, I'll do that. You got about 40 seconds. Anything you want to leave with the listeners?
Well, I would just say, you know, we really need to lean into housing as a region. I mean, this isn't something where it can be left to certain segments. I think it's something that we need to say that we need to make sure that we've got more housing, that we're trying to work to bring the price point down. It's a lot of solutions, and I think we can roll up our sleeves, and I touched on it a minute ago, but that economic development, I can't say enough that we've got to make sure that we're creating an environment to attract and grow jobs here in this community.
And through that, economic development will lead to jobs, opportunities, increased incomes, increased average residential family household incomes, which will lead to more opportunities for people to get into housing.
No question.
And so I agree with you 100% on that. It's for the betterment of the community and the region at large. So that's the voice of David Godleski with the Southern Arizona Home Builder Association. I appreciate you taking the time with us today, David, and keep up all the good work.
Thank you, Ted.
You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be back after the break with Stephen Levine from RJP Estate Planning. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, and I'm joined now by Stephen Levine from RJP Estate Planning. Stephen, will the people that you love lose out on money and the property you work so hard to leave them with without the right estate plan in place? The answer might surprise most people. Stephen from RJP Estate Planning is here to explain what really happens when there's no legal plan to protect your family. Stephen, what are the risks for surviving family members when their parents pass away without an estate plan?
Hey, Ted. Good morning. Yeah, so when there's no estate plan, children left behind could be in for a really big, unpleasant surprise. We talk about this a lot. Because before they can inherit anything, they have to go through a long and expensive legal process called probate court. Probate's a legal process that could take months, sometimes even years, before money and property can be given to surviving family members. The expense of probate could be a crushing blow for those that are inheriting your assets. So we're talking attorney fees, court costs. These can take away tens of thousands of dollars. We've seen it in probate from what your kids should have inherited. So in Arizona, specifically the state, the probate thresholds are very low. Lower than a lot of other states. So if you're in Arizona and you own a home worth more than about $100,000, which, I mean, I don't think any homes are less than $100,000 these days, especially here in Tucson, or if you have assets over $75,000 in personal assets, which includes savings, retirement accounts, you know, checking, your family could be tied up in probate court for a year or even longer before they see a penny of their inheritance. So, I mean, we're talking accounts are frozen. Somebody's going to have to come out of their own pocket to pay for your bills. At RJP Estate Planning, we see this all the time. So grieving families come into us after losing parents. Instead of being able to grieve, they're really stuck dealing with court paperwork or legal fees and you know, freeze outs with the accounts, long delays. Many people are under the impression that, and they think just having a will is enough, but it's not. A will still has to go through probate court. The absolute safest way to avoid probate and protect your assets is to create what's called a living trust.
Stephen, thank you for being with us this morning. I mean, that sounds incredibly frustrating, especially for people who have just lost a loved one. Can you help families in this situation?
Yes and no. So unfortunately, you know, families whose parents are clients of RJP and they've done a living trust with us, it's kind of a breath of fresh air. They come in and say, okay, great, we have a living trust. There's no waiting for the family. There's no court involvement, no legal mess. When their parents pass away, surviving family members can quickly inherit everything their parents left behind. As part of RJP Estate Planning's free support settlement, we personally guide families through that grieving and inheritance process so they're not left struggling. Anytime people call us after losing parents, the first thing we check is to see if they're clients of us, of ours. If they don't have the proper documents, that's when things, get tough. We have to inform them, hey, you might have to go through a probate. There is no trust. You don't have the right documents in place. A lot of people will come in and say, well, my parents talked about getting an estate plan, but they never did. Some people come in and say, unfortunately, we don't have a trust, but my parents had a will hoping it'll help. When we explained to these people that without the proper estate plan or only a will, their only option potentially is probate court. That's when we see frustration. It's a tough situation. It causes, anger. People feel that it's unfair that everything their parents worked for so hard for their whole life is now caught up in a legal battle. And that battle could last over a year and cost a lot of money.
Quite often, Stephen, parents and children don't talk about that, but no parent really wants their children to go through this. Stephen, why do probate court settlements take so long, and why can they be so expensive?
Yeah, so probate court's a slow burn. It's a step-by-step process. Legal fees can add up depending on how long that process takes, how long they're waiting to see a judge. Here in Arizona, there's thousands of cases in the system every year. It's backed up. By the time your family's case is even seen or heard, a long and expensive process can begin. Once you're at that step, especially if you've owned a home or have assets over $75,000 when you pass away, it's because the court has to have sort of a checklist. They have to decide who inherits what, appoint somebody to handle the process. They have to ensure that all of your debts and taxes are paid first before anything's paid out. They also have to notify creditors. It's public. Give them access to claim what they're owed, which means money essentially is coming out of the estate and not going to the people you want it to go to, family, kids, their inheritance. All this takes time. And if family members disagree who should get what, it can take even more time and cost even more money. And we've seen it drag out for years. In the meantime, while your estate's in probate court, your bank accounts, like I said, are frozen, meaning the money can't be used to pay your bills. If you've had a home loan, your children could be stuck paying your mortgage, your property tax, your homeowner's insurance, all out of their pockets while waiting for a probate settlement to finish. At the end of the day, the legal fees and probate expenses to settle your estate could take away tens of thousands of dollars that really should have gone to your loved ones. So to answer your question, yes, your children could lose a big part of your inheritance if their parents pass away without an estate plan.
So, Stephen, what's the solution to make sure that that doesn't happen?
Yeah, so solution's simple, Ted. Create a living trust before it's too late. A living trust costs really a fraction of what probate court settlement could cost, not to mention how long the probate settlement could take. Just to kind of recap, a living trust avoids probate, so your family gets everything quickly and easily. Keeps your estate private, so no one can make any false claims on your assets. Your trust clearly states who gets what, so there's no confusion or fighting between family members. And lastly, a trust could cost far less than formal probate. So that right there saves your family a lot of time, frustration, and money.
Stephen, I have a living trust. The people that I talk to quite often all have learned that a living trust is a much safer way to protect your assets than a will. Do you think more people are starting to recognize this?
Yeah, and it's great. I really do. I think there's sort of a smarter consumer out there with more access to information, technology, internet, more people that learn about this and learn that a will, which once was a centerpiece of an estate plan, are learning that a will isn't the safest way to protect your assets anymore, especially in Arizona. So through education and gradual shift from wills to trust, it's becoming clear, especially for people who do not want their estate to end up in probate court. So Ted, a recent study found that 50% of people over the age of 60 are now motivated to create an estate plan specifically to avoid probate court. A living trust keeps your estate out of probate, even though more people are still have wills than trust. Another recent study shows that the highest percentage of people who start the process for estate planning do it because either there's a recent medical diagnosis, they experienced the death of a loved one and had to go through probate, or that loved one had a trust and they kind of saw how much simpler it was. Or they're nearing or entering that retirement phase. So these three things apply to most people over 60. And when 50% of people over 60 want their estate to avoid probate, they're much more likely to create a living trust than a will. So we find this with RJP clients. After we educate them on the difference between trust and wills and how to avoid probate, people are choosing to create a trust, not a will. So as more people learn about probate court, how it works, the money, the draining on families' inheritance, they'll start to take action to protect their assets and families.
So we've talked about the risks of probate and the advantages of living trusts over wills. And I know RJP estate planning helps a lot of families create those living trusts. So what's the next steps for our listeners?
Sure. So yeah, at RJP Estate Planning, we've helped families do this affordably for the past 30 years. There's over 40,000 families in Arizona that have trusted us to help them protect everything that really matters the most to them. So we offer first step for a free one-hour consultation. We review your assets, explain how to protect them, and unlike many estate planning firms, we don't charge an hourly fee. Instead, you'll get a clear, one-time, flat fee with no surprises. That flat fee includes RJP's exclusive services like free settlement support, which I think is probably the most important. That's where we personally sort of hold the hands of your family members, guide them through that grieving and inheritance process after you pass. And so, yeah, the flat fee gets you everything from our services to a living trust to power of attorney documents, you name it, everything to kind of consolidate your wishes in one place. And right now, if you're over 60, we're offering the 65% discount on a living trust to really give you the peace of mind, make sure your future finances for your family and are protected. So give us a call, save the 65% on a trust. If you're over 60, call us by this Thursday. The number is 520-441-4523. Again, that's 520-441-4523.
Stephen, thank you as always for sharing your powerful insights. Again, for our listeners, if you own a home or have a home or have more than $75,000 in assets, don't put this off. If you're over 60, call 520-441-4523 by this Thursday to lock in a 65% savings on the living trust with RJP Estate Planning. At call now, 520-441-4523. Stephen, as always, we appreciate you sharing your insight and the support you give to those, because nobody wants to find themselves in a situation that breaks apart families and children and siblings. So thank you for all you do, and we look forward to having you back again.
Thanks, Ted. Take care. Have a good week.
Stephen, have a great week. Thank you.
Bye.
All right, you've been listening.
What a busy day today, Ted.
It has, and look at that. We've got it in. We learned a little bit about affordable housing. We learned about the politics of support from Teresa Martinez. She's a force to be reckoned with up at the state legislature, and now we can go see what happens at the Board of Supervisors meetings, or at least I will.
That's right.
So a lot going on in the community right now, and it's good to have you back, Matt. Brendan did an incredible job last week.
Yes, he did.
And I threw him a lot of curveballs, more than I threw you today. But you can always count on the Morning Voice. You're going to get a little curveball every now and then. So I want to encourage everybody to have a great week. I want to encourage you to listen in to 10:30 The Voice every morning from 7 to 9 o'clock to listen to The Morning Voice. It's been great talking with you today. Tune in to Grant Krueger tomorrow, and everybody have a great week.